Call me Fellini.
Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of fthismovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and this is a legendary moment in F This Movie history, because after I feel like a few years of maybe trying to put it together, I am joined by one of truly my favorite movie lovers in the world. You know him as the co-host of Shockwaves and the new-ish Pure Cinema podcast, my two favorite movie podcasts, no bullshit, Mr. Elric Kane. Welcome to the show, Elric.
And we could only finally come together over a joint love of a sexy woman.
There is no better topic for us.
We are like old perverts. Like, it's so sad. Like, two married guys with kids. Like, you'd think we would have gotten together for, like, Italian zombie movies or something with, you know, the of mutual sensibility. But instead, it's about, you know, a scantily clad Amazonian woman.
And P.S., this is like our consolation prize. What it was supposed to be was us in a room together watching a marathon of Sybil Danning movies.
Well, we were going to do Sybilthon 2017, which I think maybe this is going to be a yearly thing where either we record something about some other Sybil Danning film we hadn't seen, or we finally get it together. And maybe we have to – now watching it together won't be enough. I feel like when we get together, we need to like find the prints and put on like a mini festival somewhere and then fly Sybil in.
I think that would actually be successful. No shit. Like out in, especially out where you're at in LA.
I actually would do it. I think in the Music Box, you might get even more because, you know, people don't get the chance to maybe meet someone like that ever, you know?
That is true. I don't think she's been out here for anything. Not that I can remember. I might be wrong. Yes. So it is Junesploitation and today is Sybil Danning Day, the day this podcast comes out. And that is not a mistake. I put it on this day knowing that Elric and I wanted to do a Sybil Danning-themed episode. But truly, before we talk Sybil, I just want to say thank you for your other podcast that you host. I've been such a vocal fan of first Killer POV and now Shockwaves, and now you have Pure Cinema. And truly, that show scratches a completely different itch for me, and I love it. And both shows, every week I come away with wanting to check out a bunch of new movies or even rewatch movies that I've seen a bunch of times, but just hearing you guys talk about them always gets me excited to revisit them. So thank you for that.
Well, and we thank you too for, you know, that we need a bit of dick sucking here at the start. we thank you for, you wrote a big article at one point and it's funny. People don't realize it, but I think with free things, you know, and podcasts are obviously part of that world of just stuff that now gets put out into the ether and then is just, you know, absorbed. And often that might be a one-way situation. When somebody takes the time to write you a comment or tell you what the show means to you or tell other people, it really, I think you might not realize it, but it really keeps the longevity of that thing going, because I think we sometimes, especially if you do it every week, you know, after a couple of years, people hit certain peers, they're like, should we keep doing this? And then suddenly somebody will kind of re-energize you with their comments. And I feel like that was one of those key things somebody did for the show without being asked, you know, that, you know, energized us. I assume new people too, but more importantly for us, it was like energizing us to go, oh, that's really cool that people who are doing things we also respect and their shows are saying, listen, so it was cool, you know? So we mutually thank each other. Let's just get butter on our bodies and rub up against the statue.
I'm going to wait until we start talking about Sybil to take the butter out.
All right. That's the Brando line.
Pass the butter.
So how do we want to launch into this?
Well, I think people need to know a little bit about her origins. She actually hails from a poster that was on my wall once, and she just entered the world from there. So as a young man, I just would look at this poster and do things to myself, and she just like somehow physically materialized into our world. That's her backstory. That's all you need to know. She is my Red Sonja. That's like, she's not the Red Sonja. She's my Red Sonja.
Okay. You've actually interviewed Sybil Danning before on your old show, Inside Horror, and I tried to rewatch some of that this weekend and then couldn't because it made me uncomfortable.
It is pretty well. For one, I gotta say, I don't remember the last time somebody intimidated me. I found her to be intimidating in a way that exactly what I respect about her on screen presence and why I'm kind of drawn to her in person was. And also she's a little older now and very. She was also wearing sunglasses. It's hard to not.
I'm glad you mentioned the sunglasses because did you know you could buy these sunglasses?
Oh my God. So anyway, for people who don't know what we're talking about, I did get the chance to get her on a show and I was very excited about it. And I don't mean this in a way people talk about old people, but you know, sometimes if you haven't seen a star for a while, you genuinely wonder, not necessarily are they alive, but like, you know, do they live anywhere that you could remotely get? I know she's originally from Austria. So part of me was like, I guess maybe she retired to Austria. And then when I found out, oh no, she's LA based still and could reach out and get her on a show, I was really excited. But she did come on the show. It's a live show, so there wasn't much I could do to stop this. And she was wearing these dark sunglasses, kind of look like the Terminator, Lady Terminator. And she wouldn't take them off for the first, I don't know, it felt like 14 hours of her staring at me in sunglasses. But I think it was probably 5 minutes or something. And it was super organ. And as soon as we introduced her, she launched into a sales pitch about her sunglasses and being the spokesmodel for these new sunglasses. That was super awkward, but
I'm glad you mentioned her, that quality that she has on screen, because as I'm revisiting some of her filmography over the last week, I'm trying to figure out why. Besides, I'm going to do my best to not just come off like a disgusting man and talk about why we are drawn to her on screen, because yes, part of it is an almost impossible physical beauty. She looks like a drawing out of a comic book, you know, not like a person.
She's like the Arnie. I mean, not that Arnie was like necessarily attractive to woman, because obviously, you know, his face and stuff, but I feel like it's the same attraction that Arnie had in a peak time, or Stallone as Rambo, that she had, like physical, like strength and power, but also, you know, because we're young guys at the time, she's also beautiful. So it's a unique quality that I don't think really there were many people like her.
But she's not often talked about in the same ways that a Pam Grier is talked about. And Pam Grier has that same kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And she's revered for playing these really tough roles and just commanding the screen in such a way. And I feel like Sybil Danning does a lot of that too. And maybe it's because I don't think she got the same kinds of roles that Pam Grier got. It was rare actually that Sybil kind of played a lead. She was usually a supporting role, whereas Pam Grier got those great vehicles in the 70s to kind of show what she could do.
Yeah, and don't forget what, like, I can't speak because I wasn't alive at the time, but hindsight's a powerful thing, and Sybil Danning never got her late Tarantino movie.
Right.
You know? And so those people who do get, like, Sid Haig, I mean, imagine him without Rob Zombie. People would look back as this curio actor, and his work would still have been great, but we wouldn't have thought about him with anything else to that career, and I think Pam Grier is a big part of that. I think like all the blaxploitation and Coffee and stuff, as much as Coffee is like one of my, you know, almost top 10 kind of movies for me, I think back and go, yeah, but would I have been that familiar with it had I not had a reason to really think about her and look back? Same with Robert Forster or somebody, like certain actors. So I feel like Sybil's definitely somebody who I'm genuinely kind of surprised, especially after meeting her. She still has all the goods in terms of acting, like still can carry herself, seems physically able, mentally all there. Like you're like, oh, so I wonder why she hasn't had that kind of comeback role or something really interesting. And sometimes people have, and I can't speak for her, but some people have reputations of being hard to work with. Other people have bad agents, you know, who lose them jobs. Sid Haig's, I mean, you probably know that story, but Sid Haig's agent lost him the Marcellus Wallace role in Pulp Fiction, that he was up for it before Ving Rhames. And because he was so far off the radar at that point, the agent didn't even take the offer seriously and didn't know, you know, like kind of threw it in the garbage. So Sid never saw it. So shit like that happens in Hollywood. You know, it's a weird industry in that way. So, you know, but I am kind of surprised because I think she's got, I mean, I know she played a nurse in Halloween 2 or something, but that's not the same thing.
Yeah, like the few things she's shown up in, it's been kind of as a, like a novelty. Not like, hey, look, I'm bringing back Sybil Danning. It's more just like, hey, Rob Zombie kind of does that a lot where it's like, hey, remember this person you used to like? Well, here they are in a cameo, you know.
But she can actually act. Like, even doing this, what we're doing today, was interesting, because at times you feel like, yeah, maybe she's this powerful sex symbol and kind of strength, a strong woman, kind of almost vying for action star equality, I think, at one point. Like, that was probably her goal, was to be considered like Stallone and Arnie were during that period. And it just goes to show how difficult it would have been for a woman to have that same kind of selling point about them. But she had everything you could need to do that, as far as I can tell. But she really can act. Like, not all these films do you get to see that, but there's enough of them, and a couple that we'll talk about, where I'm like, oh yeah, no, I mean, there's no question she's an actual thespian, you know, not just a symbol, you know. Right. So yeah, but she's, you know, it's like, even with what the popularity of Wonder Woman now, I look back and go, yeah, I mean, she was doing a lot of these things and trying to be. I found a quote by her just before we did this, where she just said, "I love playing women who are not ashamed to be strong. There are many of us out there, you know, and we would love to see more of us on screen." And that's probably from like 1985.
Yeah.
You know, and so it takes a long time, but it's, I don't know, it's, I'd love to see her pop up in that kind of a world, or Thor. She'd be so good in the world of Thor. Like, she looks like a Viking goddess, you know?
She could have been one of the Amazons in Wonder Woman. She could have been on that island.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. but I want to.
And I wonder too, and I think the world is a different place now, where I think you are a little bit more allowed to, because she was also so kind of affiliated with, you know, posters on boys' walls and a Playboy spread that she had done. And so it was like, she was so kind of heavily considered a sex symbol that maybe she wasn't always taken as seriously as an actress. And I feel like the world is a little bit, and maybe I'm wrong, and maybe our female listeners are pulling their hair out right now, but I feel like the world is a little bit more accepting of being able to be considered both, where one isn't a stigma for the other anymore.
It's hard to know. I mean, if, I guess, like, if Jessica Chastain did Playboy now, would she be taken seriously? I don't think so. You know? So it's a tough one. That's hard to know. I think it depends what kind of actor you are, what kind of world. If you're just doing action movies, maybe she could do both now. But I feel like, I don't know, it's hard to think, if as long as men hold the purse strings to these things, they probably control. It's tough. And it's tough to, you know, to know. But I mean, I feel like, why she didn't get bigger, like, she's big at a certain level, but if you actually go through her credits, your average person isn't going to know maybe any of these movies. Yeah. And that's the difference between some of these people. Whereas one of the things that I did know about her a long time ago, and I don't know when I first learned it, but was that she was like a Bond girl, you know, like, that's how I thought of her when I was young, because a lot of her photo shoots look like that, the ones she'll be wearing, you know, holding a gun, wearing a black leather swimsuit or whatever. And she actually came, you know, runner up for Octopussy to Maude Adams. And that fact, I think, it maybe speaks volumes about the kind of career she has. Like, if she had had that role, you know, that probably would have been a different kind of, potentially different legacy to an extent, you know, but who knows? I think she would have been awesome in that world, as more than just a Bond girl, but like a villain or a femme fatale, because she's just got that, you know, that Euro, just like that power, because she's not even that tall. She comes off as like 6'3".
I would swear that she was 7 feet tall. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she seems gigantic. She's only like 5'7" or something, which is really hard to believe. Because that is not the physical. The other thing you were saying about sex and her as a sex symbol is interesting, is that, you know, it says a lot about her that she's just not shy in that way. And like, in photo shoots and in some of the movies we talk about, you can tell the confidence with which she does, say, a nude scene versus some of the other films where somebody else is also nude. And you can tell it's the last thing on earth that person wants to be doing. And it, you know, tells you a lot about her, where she's from, and that kind of confidence that I think is actually a really admirable trait, because really it's not that bad a thing. You know what I mean? As long as you're not taking advantage of the person being nude, as long as they know what they signed up for, it's just nude. And it can be a, you know, so it's, I know, definitely different than your average American. She's half American, I think, half Austrian. So, and I think she grew up on military bases, from the little I saw biographically about her. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. So, you know, just a very confident strength. And even doing that interview, like, you could tell that she knows how to hold herself. She knows what she's doing. her Facebook feed, it's a different story.
She's oh, like, I haven't seen her Facebook feed.
She posts crazy shit. Like, she's the person, friends of mine, we will always take a screenshot of what she's – anytime somebody famous dies – If there's a tragedy in the world or somebody famous dies, she will post the like something obscurely about them or that she met them with a nude, like a semi-nude photo of herself and something else inappropriate. And you'll be like, what is she thinking? Like, it just makes no – it's one of the craziest things. I'm pretty sure it's only Facebook. I'm not sure if she also does it on Twitter, but it's pretty outrageous. Like some of the – just if somebody dies and there'll be some photo of her scantily clad and she'll – with them and she or something. Sometimes it won't even connect and you'll be like, what is she alluding to here? And it's a lot of stuff with ex-presidents. She must have been like, I think she had one career on screen but a much bigger career off screen,
right? With
not just necessarily love lives but just knowing people socially, like from Clint Eastwood to Ronald Reagan to everyone. I mean, really, I think she, you know, like had, I mean, I bet if she had a biography, it'd probably be amazing. You know, if you wrote that. Sybil, if you're listening.
I have learned that you should never get to know some of the people that like you once had a crush on Facebook, because I friended an actress. It's probably okay to say her name because she's never going to listen to this. One of my first childhood crushes ever was an actress named Jennifer Runyon. Do you know who Jennifer Runyon is?
What's she in?
She's the girl who's getting the test at the beginning of Ghostbusters that Bill Murray's like hitting on.
Yeah.
And she's in that David Hess movie, To All a Good Night.
I haven't seen that one.
It's a trip. So I think that was her first movie. So I had this big crush on her, and then recently somehow we became Facebook friends, and it was like right around the election, and I was like, oh no, am I going to have to unfriend Jennifer Runyon?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's always tough. It is tough. It is weird. We're also in a weird time to like even be allowed to know what people worshipped as a kid, or like just even, you know, Martin Scorsese or somebody, and then they'll be on Twitter and you'll be like, oh, this is weird that even if you don't respond, the very fact that I can even scream at you is weird.
Right.
Yeah, the accessibility has never been quite like this. But, you know, at least me and Sybil are on LinkedIn, you know. The timing of that was remarkable.
That's amazing.
For those who don't know what I'm talking about, it was like literally a day ago and it popped up on my LinkedIn feed. It said, what did it say? It said, you know, you and Sybil Danning, or Sybil, you know, congrats. I don't know, it was something about Sybil Danning. And I was like, I didn't even know me and Sybil Danning were connected on LinkedIn, but B, the timing that we were about to do this was hilarious.
Right,
so I screenshot. Maybe it's all because I just did that one episode. Somehow it knows everything. The computer, it knows. It knows what we're doing. Which means it looked at, it knows the photos I was just looking up of people, so that's also bad for me.
Do we want to talk about some of our favorite Sybil movies? How do you want to structure this, or just go through some of the highlights?
If you remember where you first even became aware, because I feel like she wasn't someone I knew that well when I was super young. But do you remember the first time you saw her in anything?
I do, because it was the Lou Ferrigno adaptation of Hercules, the Canon Films adaptation. And for whatever reason, I think because as a kid, I was, you know, into Arnold Schwarzenegger, and my brother would read all these like fantasy novels, and they all had covers that looked like Frank Frazetta paintings, and all the advertising for Hercules made it look like one of those novels kind of come to life. So I was dying to see the movie Hercules, and I didn't see it probably till it showed up on cable, and she's the villain in that movie and made quite an impression on a young me.
Yeah, you wouldn't last 3 seconds.
and possibly Battle Beyond the Stars, I feel, but I don't know that I put it together that like that was the same person.
She's like particularly stunning in that, like just the makeup and the costume kind of almost make her look. She does look otherworldly in that. It's a pretty amazing get up.
And again, just because of that headdress, but I mean, she just blows everyone else off the screen. Like the way that they've costumed her, she's so larger than life. That's one of those roles where you would swear she's 7 feet tall, because she just seems like this Viking queen that has come down from heaven.
Yeah, something that disturbed me about I just read before we started was that she's very good friends with Gail Ann Hurd, and that just made me even more like mad. I was like,
yeah, right.
Like Gail Ann Hurd, put her on The Walking Dead. Imagine that character walking and blowing away zombies. I'm like, in The Walking Dead needs to be sexier. That's what that movie, that show's lacking.
Or at least make her like the matriarch of the new town that they try to start before it all goes to shit.
Before they take it over and run it.
That show just keeps making the...
It's not getting predictable.
Keeps doing the same story.
But yeah, the first, I mean, well, I remember seeing it. Howling 2, the first time I saw that, I remember not liking it, like when I was super young, at least the tone of it being so flat, because it is still kind of boring.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, it's somehow boring, even though it's so bonkers. It shouldn't be boring, but it just somehow is. But man, you don't forget her playing that Sturba character, because she is, again, it's otherworldly. She is just this really strong, it's kind of gross because she also is hairy at one point, you know, and it's like,
don't care.
Also, no, I know, and it also pulls you in, but then the movie ends with the credit sequence, which is like the most memorable thing for anyone under 15 who's a boy or, you know, or swings that way, you know, who could ever watch that. I mean, it is, and it's also the most exploitive thing I think I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, yeah.
But it's like, I mean, maybe she doesn't give a shit, you know, it wouldn't surprise me of all people, but still, it's like they're editing a montage of credits where she's flashing every, like, you know, 30 seconds and repeated. And it's just, when you're young, you're like, whoa, I didn't know that could happen. Yeah.
I feel like I've heard that she was not happy about that.
Oh, yeah.
The repeating on a loop. That's funny because the first time I saw that movie again, I knew who she was, but I don't think I had known about like her play, you know, being in Playboy. And I hadn't seen a lot of her other movies. So when she kind of does the nude scene, I was like, this is a revelation. This is a big deal, because the movie almost kind of builds up to it. And so I thought it was like, oh, this is that one time that Sybil Danning got naked on screen. And then it turns out like, oh, actually, that's happened quite a few times. But when I first saw The Howling 2, I thought I was witnessing a miracle. And I kind of was.
Oh, yeah, it's a crazy, and that's actually, of all the killer POVs we did, one of the best stories. There's a good chance to like link back to something.
Yeah.
Is Philippe Mora, the director, Australian/French, you know, director, has great stories about the making of that and her and the costumes, and it's pretty hilarious. I mean, that sounds like behind the scenes, just everything, sex stuff, just sounds nuts.
And those stories made me feel bad for not liking the movie more. He seemed just like such a nice guy, that because I'm not the biggest Howling 2 fan, even though I think if you're going to talk about kind of essential Sybil Danning, I think that movie has to be part of the conversation, because as you said, that character is so commanding and so larger than life, that if any other actress was playing that part, I almost feel like no one would need to see that movie, but she makes that movie worth watching. I mean, there's the craziness too, but like her performance is actually why I would genuinely recommend the movie.
Yeah, I can't think of much. I mean, even Christopher Lee makes it kind of flatter and somehow slightly dull and overly serious, you know?
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, he has that one of the best lines in the history of all movies at the start of that, where he goes, your sister is a werewolf. and you're just like, man, that's a good line. Like, your sister is a werewolf, you know, at a funeral wearing sunglasses. But, you know, it's not the best movie, but it's really memorable, her role. And I don't think I knew who she was, but I remember, and I probably thought she was Red Sonja when I was young, going back to that. Like, I think she just had such a like presence. And you know, it's something sometimes missing in cinemas, are these people who, you know, a generation of people who all had like real physical attributes, or, I mean, even the Gene Hackmans of the world. I look at people now and I'm like, oh, but if it's all CW type stuff,
right,
at some point, isn't it all just going to become nothing? You know, if people all start looking the same, you just do not see the same kind of character actors or these kind of outside the box characters. I mean, I haven't seen Wonder Woman yet, but I'll be curious to see, you know, is it Gal Gadot?
Gadot, yeah.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what she's like in that role. It seemed like a good outside the box casting.
I was, not to go on a Wonder Woman side track, but I, you know, was one of those people who was like, oh, what? I had only known her from the Fast and Furious movies and couldn't really imagine it, which a lot of times is kind of the best way to be surprised, because when it's a no-brainer, you know, you go in exactly knowing what to expect. I was blown away by what she does in that movie. I think it's so good and interesting, and like, I didn't know that I wanted to see a Wonder Woman movie. I don't have a ton of attachment to the character. And I was like, how do you make Wonder Woman interesting on screen? Because isn't she just like, I'm good all the time? And that's not super compelling. And then you see the movie and you realize all these different shades that she brings to it. She's really, really terrific.
Yeah, but would she do a shower scene in a prison film?
I don't know that she would. And that's exactly where Sybil has the advantage.
Sybil's got you back. Sybil's got it. You don't need to do that shower scene because Sybil will do it. We have Sybil. And we have many movies to talk. So we both up front, part of our impetus for even wanting to do a Sybil-thon was because you had a Sybil Danning film that you really wanted me to see.
Yes.
And that I had only not seen because I was waiting for a Blu-ray. I knew about it, but I didn't know quite the extent of its glory. And then I have one that just I have been holding out talking about anywhere for like about, I don't know, as long as I've been doing podcasts, because I've been waiting for us to do a prison episode of Pure Cinema, which will happen, but I wasn't going to talk about it till then, but I'm going to unleash when we talk about it today, because it's all about the Sybil. And that's the first, and that movie when we get to is the first time I realized how much I liked this person, had to look her up and realize, oh, you're that same person I saw in other movies, and
right.
Just loved her screen presence. Like, I was like, whoa, who are you? But we'll get to that. So I feel like a lot of, like all good things, this is coming about from that organic place of, oh, I just really wanted you to see this movie and talk to you about this movie, and I had this movie I want to talk to you about, and then we decided to add, you know, a couple other movies into the mix, and so we'll probably talk about five or so, maybe a couple more, you know, Sybil Danning movies that, you know, seem maybe worth watching or not. There may be one that I'd probably say pass on that I watched. That,
yeah, know. Definitely. I think I know the one you're talking about, and I would say the same thing. So let's start there, because it turns out that both of these films are actually from the same director.
Totally did not know that until we, like, I think 2 days ago, I was like, oh my God. Like, it literally floored me when I found this out. And the weirdest part in the film that I picked of the equation, there's an extra feature with Sybil Danning talking about that film, making no reference to the other film and saying, yes, and then my agent pointed me to this film about a prison, and the director was a man named Paul Nicola. And she keeps talking and never mentions that the other film. So it made me go, wait a minute, is it a different guy? Because that's just bizarre. Like, you're in the same director's movies 2 years in a row and there's no mention of the guy, so maybe there's something more to the backdrop to this. But regardless, IMDb would tell you that Paul Nicholas, and he has many other names,
always the sign of quality.
Well, why don't we start with your pick?
Sure.
Because that, I think, is the impetus for this whole shebang.
Yeah, so this was a film from 1983 called Julie Darling, a.k.a. Daughter of Death, which I did not even know it had another title until I was scanning the Amazon Prime offerings and came upon this movie called Daughter of Death and realized, oh, this is Julie Darling. And the version on Amazon Prime is not great, so I would not encourage people to watch it that way. So I saw Julie Darling just because it was a Sybil Danning movie, and I was like, well, I have to see that because Sybil's in it. And then I saw the movie and was like, oh, there's so much more in this movie than just Sybil. Don't get me wrong. Right. She's great. But I almost feel like the stuff that I love about the movie is not even Sybil related.
Yeah, she's, well, what's cool about this movie, first, the tagline, she's sweet, 16, and she simply loves her daddy. She'll slaughter you if you love him too. So good. And this movie, so I just went to, and if you heard the new Shockwaves, you know what I'm going to say. I can't believe this film wasn't programmed. I just went to a triple feature of Teen Girls in Peril movies. It was Scream for Help by Michael Winner, The Stepfather, one of the all-time great horror films, and Gary Sherman's Lisa. And this movie, like, it was so funny to see this right after, like, two days after this triple feature. This is even better than all three of them in doing the same thing. Like, I think it's very similar to Scream for Help, but to me, it's just a better movie. Scream for Help's funny and fun to watch with a crowd, but not, you know, actually as a good film. But it's almost all the same trappings. But I feel like Julie Darling just commits to like this kind of adolescent rage madness thing. That, and Daughter of Death's a completely apt title, even though it's a shitty title.
Right.
It totally explains what the movie's about. You know, it's just a teenage girl who, you know, is kind of jealous of her mother and doesn't necessarily get along with her mother as well. And the dad is the, you know, her kind of the love object in her mind. And she, you know, a guy breaks into the house and is going to, you know, possibly rape and murder her mother. And she just kind of watches and lets it happen, even though she's holding her gun from her wall of her bedroom, her 14-year-old's bedroom. And then, so you're like, whoa, this is pretty intense. And then, you know, she thinks that means her and her daddy can be together in some weird, you know, infant fantasy. But then the dad comes home with Sybil Danning, who he was already having an affair with, and is going to kind of settle down with her. And I mean, imagine your very attractive blonde mother then being replaced with, you know, 10 times the woman when Sybil Danning enters. So it's a pretty great setup. But the thing I'll say about Sybil, which is, this is the role I was actually talking about. This is where I saw her acting the most grounded and real.
Yeah.
And that's when I was like, oh, okay. So you really have a lot of range. 'Cause this isn't the tough femme fatale, ass kicking cop type character at all, or just over sex pot. She seems like a very real woman with a kid and concern. And I love how she is kind of onto the girl from very early. She sees what the dad can't in her. She sees that you really are resenting me, and this could go badly, which I thought was cool.
Yeah, she's playing kind of just a regular person, which she doesn't often do. She's usually playing kind of these larger than life characters, and obviously in a crazy situation given where the daughter is at. And I want to say, when I watched the movie, I might have like written you something on Twitter or something, because this is a movie that almost punishes you for enjoying a Sybil Danning sex scene.
Oh yeah, this is like, okay, I've seen a lot of holy fucking shit moments in my life.
I could not believe that the movie went there.
I was watching this last night with my co-host of Pearson O'Brien, who had seen it as well. And he, like you, was big somebody telling me I had to see it.
Yeah.
And I just turned to him and went, I don't think I've ever seen that. And I'm going to give this away because I don't think this is a big spoiler.
Yeah, it's fine.
Because I think you have to see it. You have the young adolescent girl opening the door after hearing crazy sex sounds, and Sybil's writing. And the best thing about this movie that no one told me to, and I was so excited, is that this was Anthony Franciosa, the star of Tenebrae, which I had no idea, playing the dad. So I've never really noticed him in other stuff besides Tenebrae. He's so memorable in that film. So here he is as Mr. Nice Guy. She is riding him, and the sounds are just crazy. And this little, you know, I don't know why, is she meant to be 14? Okay, she's about 14. In real life, I think she's 20. Thank God for the scene. So she's watching them have sex in a close-up with basically a porn filter on it. Like, it's a crazy soft, blurry focus filter that's actually been put over this to feel dreamy. And then intercuts between her and naked with her father riding her, and then back to Sybil, and then back to her. And you're like, oh my God, because we're watching a child.
Yeah.
You know, in a sex scene suddenly, and as gross as that will sound, you know, knowing she's 20 makes, you know, it's at least it's not, you know, anything criminal on that level, but it's still so fucked up. But it's also like accurate to the mindset maybe of the character to show the extremity of what she's able to do. Like, maybe if you didn't see such a disturbing thing from her, you might not also believe all the other shit she does in the movie, this girl, because it's so outlandish. You maybe need a little insight into just how disturbed the fantasy runs.
Well, that's
it's crazy.
I love that the movie, I mean, for it, like as you said, as fucked up as it is, I almost wanted to cheer. Like, I couldn't believe what I was seeing, but I also wanted to cheer that the movie went there, because up until that point, it's very heavily implied that, like, she's feeling inappropriate things towards her dad. But, it, you know, maybe it's just possessive. It's this young girl's kind of selfishness, and no one else is good enough for my daddy and all that. And then the movie crosses that line in such a big way, and you're like, oh, I'm watching something totally different. And again, just the fact that they're naked in the bed, and it just made me appreciate acting, because it's like, oh, for most of this movie, they're playing father and daughter. And then they show up to set one day, and it's like, okay, now get naked in bed and kiss. And you've been pretending to be father and daughter, and how fucked up that must be to then have to do a love scene.
Oh, yeah. And you always wonder if these things like are on the script or if somebody, you know, just, hey, I got a great idea on set.
What if nobody, today?
Yeah, and nobody raises their hand to question that idea. It's like, but isn't she playing 14? Couldn't that get us somebody here into trouble? They probably shot that part in Germany. I saw that it's a Canada-German production. They're probably like, all right, we won't shoot that shot here. Also, I don't know if you noticed, but the thing that got us most, there's a bed. So you go from the girl's bedroom and she has this little single bed. And then it cuts to Sybil Danning's preparing the bedroom of the adults to kind of it's the mother before Sybil comes in, and the mother's preparing their bedroom like she as if she's going to seduce him or something. It's hard to tell. She's all dressed after a shower, and I swear to you, if you watch it again, it is the same single bed and has been redressed, and they shoot it from angles to avoid showing you that it's not a big bed. And my guess is they had one little bed, and it's the most absurd thing I've ever seen. It's like the idea that two adults would be in this tiny room. It's kind of an amazing moment. We're just like, wait a minute, that bed's not... But it's kind of marvelous. But but Sybil's really good in it. And I think she plays the caring mother slash, you know, new wife, and has a great twist. I like one of the best kind of final beats.
Yeah.
Dramatically for her and her career, I'd say, where it kind of gives her something playful to do. But this is a good movie. Like, this is a movie I totally would stand by with you and tell people it's worth buying on Code Red's Blu-ray, which is what I watched. Had a couple dropouts in sound, just very brief, like 1 second ones on the disc we had. But the quality visually looked really good. I'm sure it's a lot better than the online version that the Amazon version. But yeah, this is, to me, this, if you like these kind of movies, these kind of holy fucking shit, but also, like, you know, weird dysfunctional family type movies, I love those kind of films. They always just kind of, because we all come from some sort of messed up background, but it's never as crazy usually, hopefully. We'll see how our kids grow up as this.
Yeah, you guys on Pure Cinema did a whole episode on dysfunctional families. I think that's where Brian brought this movie up.
Yeah, it did, yeah.
But yeah, I just love that, you know, that it's dealing with some really dark psychological stuff and then goes about it in such a lurid way. I mean, even before we get to the weird sex stuff, you have all the stuff with Julie and the snake, and just, it kind of tells you right up front, like, this movie's going to be kind of fucked up, and you settle in for it, and it's super entertaining.
Yeah, and films like told kind of almost from the perspective of a teenager like this, and it really is the same for the Scream for Help one I was mentioning, are really fun because you feel like everything's skewered in such an over-the-top way, but then you realize, oh, it's probably because, in a sense, the narrator is this 14-year-old's vision of sexuality and, you know, of jealousy and all this stuff. So it does feel heightened in a silly way, but it really works. And yeah, that movie was, I was very happy that I wasn't going to come on show shitting on such a great movie. It, you know, that's always the fear when somebody tells you, man, I love this movie.
Right.
And you're watching like, oh man, it's, you know,
it did not disappoint. I'm glad.
Does not disappoint. And that I have to say, of the year so far, my number one holy fucking shit moment is that sex scene for sure.
Nice.
Because I just did not know you were even allowed to do that.
Right.
All right. Well, then my two cents of like my just this is a movie that I saw it at a 24-hour movie marathon in New Zealand a long time ago. Aunt Timpson from New Zealand puts on these amazing films. He has all the reels. I mean, he has all the film prints. And, you know, I've seen a lot of woman in prison movies, and I like a lot of them, a lot of Jack Hill stuff. But this one took the cake, and it's called Chain Heat. Same director, Paul Nicholas. It's the year before, or same year.
IMDb says same year.
Okay, so probably, you know, maybe one was being shot before.
Right.
This one, unfortunately, on the DVD pack is presented by Mr. Skin, which already made me feel bad for my feelings towards this movie. Like, as if that wasn't bad enough. Now I have to be reminded of what I did 4 years ago on the internet. It's just not cool. Thank you, Mr. Skin, for that. But this movie, I was worried to rewatch again because I haven't rewatched it. But in the theater, I remember this being the most entertaining 2 hours I'd ever had. And watching again on this DVD, I actually felt exactly the same, which was fantastic. But the best reaction was my wife was on the couch about to go to bed, and I put this on, and usually she would not even wait for it to start. She would just, you know, like, go to bed in the situation like this. And she watched the first 5 minutes, and she just turned, and she's never said anything like this about any movie I've ever watched. She got up and she goes like, this seems like sexist, misogynistic, racist, and like just kind of nasty. And I just looked at her and I said, And it's because it's all those things at once that make this movie work. Because any one of those strands could make the movie awful and like, oh, what a terrible movie or depiction. But because it's all of those things in harmony, perfectly at playing at 11 from start to final scene, I'm like, how could somebody, like, especially also when you think about Julie Darling, this movie is like holy fucking shit every fucking moment.
Right, right.
And it's like, how did the guy, I feel like Julie Darling's like him making it almost, you know, a held back, restrained.
He watched the dailies of that sex scene. He was like, how can I translate this to a feature length?
I know. So this is really from the start. It's a prison movie. This is part of when Linda Blair was trying, you know, and I'm a huge Savage Streets fan.
Yeah, oh yeah.
This is her trying to, you know, definitely be an edgy material, exploitation material. She is going to jail for what she says is just like running some guy over, and everyone else is really bad. Everyone else is repeat offender. They call her virgin because she's a first time, you know, offender. But they set up the actual prison, like, you know, the worst place on earth. But it's got all these different factions, and they're half the time they're walking around weird parts of the prison where you're like, no prisoners walking, you know, totally ludicrous prison. This is like the most ridiculous. But the warden, and I talk about him all the time on my show, and this is my favorite role ever by any actor, is John Vernon in as the warden in this movie. He has a hot tub in his, like, you know, in his office at a prison. You're like, what? So he's able to like take whichever girls he wants, and he kind of seduces them. He's the least rapey character, even though he's still total slime ball and is like, you know, totally inappropriate with everyone. But, you know, the people below him are much worse. It's a lot of violent, crazy, you know, really awful imagery in this, but he's particularly sleazy because he's always filming them and making little things. And I had to write it down because it's the greatest line I've heard this year, where he's filming one of the girls with his camera and he's sitting in the hot tub and she says, what about this, warden? He's like, don't call me warden, call me Fellini.
I literally wrote down the exact same line because I was like, that is just the referencing
cinema.
Fellini in Chained Heat.
JT, it was so great. And it's so anyway, they sets up a faction that he's running drugs through the prison. But there's another faction. Oh, you just John Vernon. You thought he was the only great actor. Throw in Henry Silva as a pimp running the girls from out. He takes the girls out of the prison and takes them to entertain men, you know, at parties, and then brings them back into the jail without anyone noticing. That's his side gig. And Stella Stevens, who was like, who's kind of the head cop, I guess, inside the prison, she's not the warden, whatever's below that. She's kind of with him in a sense. He's using her to get to, you know, to kind of take over the prison. She was like a really legit mainstream, you know, actress before that, like in, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So it's got pretty great. And I don't know if you knew this, but the black actress Tamara Dobson, who was kind of the we haven't introduced Sybil Danning yet, but she's the, there's kind of two factions, kind of like, it's actually a lot like Orange is the New Black, but like, you know, obviously way more over the top,
right?
But we've got the different racial factions. So she's like part of the prison where all the black people are kind of together, and kind of you don't stray into each other's territory. Sybil Danning plays Erica, who is the head of like this tough, you know, I don't even know. They're kind of an ugly group that she represents. But Tamara Dobson was Cleopatra Jones.
Right.
And I did not know that when I watched this movie. And when I watch again, I was like, oh, so no wonder they have to kind of give them this equal, her and Sybil really have an equal billing the way they're treated in terms of their toughness and that you can even tell the reputation of the actor on screen. They're not going to like one dominate over the other. They're letting them kind of be real rivals and equals, which is super cool. I thought the stuff between them was great. But there's so much in this movie that is just, it's like one of the most inappropriate, over the top. Like, you know, it's just Sybil Danning just totally naked walking up to Linda Blair, who clearly did not want to be naked. This is like the first nude scene she'd done. And Sybil on the extras talks about how she tried to cheer her up and kept saying, what a nice body you have, don't feel bad, you know. And they're just in the shower together as other girls are like totally going at it in the showers, you know, in other parts of the scene. It is a real bonkers one, but it has so much energy. Like, you know, not a second's wasted. Just stuff's always happening. People are always getting, you know, you're getting killed in jail, or, you know, running drugs, or, you know, deception and gang attacks. And I think it's America now.
Every time. Again, we're doing this Junesploitation thing on our site this month, and I think there are some people who just don't dig on exploitation movies, and I get it. But if you are somebody who likes these kinds of movies, like Chained Heat is the reason why. You know what I mean? It's like
stumbling upon, like, it's worth watching 10 really kind of boring exploitation to come across something like this, like where you just aren't ready for it, when you're like, oh my god, for the whole movie you're gonna give me this for the whole movie? Like, you know, and I guess I can understand someone not liking it, but I don't want to be their friend. You know, I've got friends,
and you have,
I
want to
be friends with you.
Legit great,
I know you'll like this.
Legit great actors, like, committing to this material. Linda Blair, I think, seems a little bit, I don't want to say lost. I mean, part of it is that she's given
perm. She's got that nice little dog perm.
There is so much goddamn hairspray in that prison. I could not believe the size of the hair.
An amazing 80s prison.
She's playing, you know, kind of a more meek character who eventually finds herself. But it's so funny because I just watched the other day, we were having a Blaxploitation day. So I had on my DVR Cleopatra Jones and the City of Gold or whatever that sequel is. I had literally just seen it, and then today I was watching Chain Heat, and I was like, holy shit, I forgot that's Cleopatra Jones. I hadn't seen the movie in years, and as you were going through the plot, it was like it followed the exact beats of my reactions, because I was like, this movie's so fun, holy fuck, Henry Silva, that's right, I forgot. How could this movie get better? And like, Henry Silva is the answer every time they cut back to John Vernon either doing lines of coke off his desk or just like staring out, just zoned out. I mean, the scene that he has with Linda Blair where she says, I left, I went to this party, and he almost can't, he's like, wait, you were out of the prison? What? Who took you? What? And then he's immediately like, ah, don't worry about it, I'll take care of you.
And then he tries to have sex with her.
Well, of course.
It's like, you know, he's really one of those great actors where you're like, you'll see him in something really legit, like, oh, there's Charlie Verk, the one we talk a lot on Pearson, with that we both love. He'll be in like something legit with all these actors, then he'll be saying like this or Killer Clowns from Outer Space, and he will just shine. And it's that idea that there's just no bad roles. There's no bad, like, you know, I think Joe Spinell talks about that too. It's like, it doesn't matter what you got cast in, that's not your problem. Your job is to show up and still be as good as you are when you're opposite Clint Eastwood. And if you are, people will notice. And I think they do. I think we notice now as cult movie fans. I notice that John Vernon has – I've never seen him, even if he's phoning in, which I don't know if he is, he just is shining. You know, there's something there, and Henry Silva has got the best face of any kind of bad guy, I think. It's just such an interesting look to him. And the two of them, and then bring in Sybil. This is a great Sybil role. Like, I think the other one, Sybil, the one we were just talking about, Julie Darling's like a great grounded role for this. I think this is actually one of her best. Like, she's playing this very powerful, almost overly aggressive character at the start, who kind of feels a little one note, but then she kind of gets her comeuppance in the middle of the movie. And when she comes back into the narrative in the second half, and Linda and all the characters start kind of why I love the movie is, it might seem sexist and misogynist, all these things, but by the end of the movie, this could be something to say about the universe, when all the women decide to fight together and get their put their differences aside, they are unstoppable. And men do not stand a fucking chance, and these girls get together and from opposite ends and just like take it on. And it's so fun to watch when that part happens. And I think, again, she shows an interesting range to her, and she's just so powerful. And my god, her chest in the extras, she talks about it herself, so I don't feel like a total perv. I'm really it is astronomical. But in the extra, she's like, well, my agent was concerned putting me in a wife, like a, what do you call a singlet, because it was, I think she said something like, well, it was that time of the month, and they were just huge.
Oh my
they were
gosh.
just massive. She's saying this, and she's like, and so he was just concerned that it would just look too much, but I just thought it was great. Just let it hang out. And I'm like, go Sybil. Like, you know, don't hold back.
Her character's name in the movie is Erica, which also happens to be my wife's name. So actually, I felt okay about the things I was thinking and feeling during this movie.
Yes, you can channel that somewhere.
She has one of my favorite deliveries ever. I forget the line that Tamara Dobson says to her. She calls her some crazy creative insult, and Sybil turns to her and says, "Where do you want it?" And it's like
all time favorite moment in exploit. I'm not even kidding. Like, when she turned, even the timing of the turn. Yeah. There's something about that moment that you just never forget. But also, there's another insult that Tamara Dobson gives somebody. I think it's Vernon, and I can't remember the last time I laughed out loud, but I had a guffaw, and I'd have to rewind it, because it was just like, it was such, you know, it's like typical throwback 70s blaxploitation type line where like something motherfucker. And it was so good that I was like, oh man, this movie is just loaded. And here's the best part for me and you. that this dude made another movie that I have not seen called The Naked Cage from 3 years later. So all I know is that is all I'm going to be looking forward to between now and whenever I see this movie. I have no idea anything about it. I recognize the cover. Have you seen Naked Cage?
I have. Scream Factory just put it out on Blu-ray like maybe a month ago. And it's fun. I mean, it follows a lot of the same beats. It's fun. It's another just super sleazy women in prison movie. There is a female warden once again who is doing like a bunch of lesbian stuff in her office. She's kind of the John Vernon role and taking advantage
Patrick, what kind of lesbian stuff? I mean,
it's involved. There's like, okay. They're wearing outfits and it's a whole thing. So, I mean, the movie's fun. What it's missing, honestly, are these actors. You know, like there's cool stuff and it's sleazy and people go for it, but they're a little bit like more like B grade actors, which isn't a knock on them or their performances, but it is these actors that elevate so much of this material to where it's so entertaining and fun. So
and some of that kind of holy fucking shit stuff where it's like, oh my God, because I found that one title I'll talk about in a minute that I like felt like kind of flatlines with all these same kind of elements. Sometimes you'll see a movie that has all those same kind of beats. I'm someone who like the titillation of like shower scenes in these kind of prison movies. It's just not enough. It's kind of like nothing, you know what I mean? Like it's like, oh, it's nice. I'm not, you know, as a heterosexual male, it's like, yeah, that's nice, but it's like it's nothing. So a lot of prison movies of this kind actually don't do much for Big Dollhouse. I'm a big fan of, but 90% of the others actually do almost nothing for me. So I'm not somebody who's just, my love for this movie isn't just based on that subgenre. It's really this one particularly. It feels like it's just got something crackling every couple minutes, which is hard to do, you know.
It's really hard to do, and that's why when you stumble upon it, it's such a special thing, you know, to have all these ingredients, as you said, in just the right amount, and everything's kind of working together for something that, you know, again, you show to somebody who's not into this stuff, and it all seems so wrong, but then to people like us, it's like, yeah, but doesn't that make it so right?
And it has to be funny. That's the other thing. It has to be, you have to have that humor, and that can't all be accidental. I know some people think these movies are so bad they're good. Yeah, there's moments of that in all movies like this, but there's also purposeful humor in these movies where somebody knows that this is actually funny and crazy, and you know, and that, the ones that don't have that are a little tortury.
Yeah.
I find those ones tend to not work for me at all. I'm not big on seeing people like tortured in prison stuff. It needs to have this kind of crazy edge to it. I just love this movie, and I hope one day that there's a better release than just Mr. Skin's triple pack. And, you know, I'm kind of in awe. I think it might have come up when I was talking to Cliff McMillan and Jeff Nelson from Scream Factory. I think I might have said something, and they might have intimated that it was a possibility. I gotta see if I remember. Yeah, so that would be cool because, you know, or even just Shout Factory, you know.
Right.
It's super cool film, but... unfortunately, there was another film on that same packet that was less fun.
I think I know the one you're talking about, and I think that was a movie that I was going to bring up as well.
Well, let's see, because was yours directed by Ernst R. von Thiemer?
You know what? It sure was.
I would say this, that his name is way too epic to have made this movie. Like, I read that name, I'm like, all right, this is going to be the greatest movie ever. Ernst R. von Thiemer can't possibly let me down. It's the year after the two movies we've just been raving about, and it is Jungle Warriors.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. So what I watched was, I think, a bootleg, because I don't have that Mr. Skin 3-pack. Is the version that you watched... did it feel heavily edited?
In what way? Like action or titillation? Because Mr. Skip don't edit.
Was there like a gross rapey scene?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah.
It did not make the movie better.
No, God, no.
I feel like nothing you would have had cut out probably would have improved.
No, well, because I know there are heavily edited versions going around that cut out a lot of the violence, including, I think, the fates of some of the characters, and it also completely cuts out that gross rapey scene, which I'm all in favor of, because I got nothing from that gross rapey scene, but let me say this, in terms of a Sybil movie, I do feel like, and I'm going to, I feel horrible for saying this, but I feel like that scene does actually inform the Sybil character, because without that, she almost has nothing. She just exists as kind of like the sister of this other guy who we need to talk about. But
and it's very incestual.
Oh yeah,
their brother sister. It's Paul L. Smith. So it's not just
exactly.
Nobody. It's Mr. Pieces. It's super weird. I mean, yeah, I agree. I think this movie. Well, for one, the backdrop to this movie. Now that you're saying that, though, I'm not sure if I really saw it that bad, or I'm trying to think. I definitely didn't, maybe it is edited, but it definitely intimated a rape scene. It's about a bunch of models basically flying into the jungle, and they get stuck in the jungle, and then there's two different stories. One is a kind of drug czar in South America, and his army, including Woody Strode from Once Upon a Time in the West, which was the opening of that. And then John Vernon again. And I'd say John Vernon, like, not even trying very hard and still being good, just walking through a movie as kind of mafia who are coming through. So it's a pretty blah story, and it never has the kind of what the fuck, like, fun moments. It's a lot more kind of – it's just a little more seedy. I posted the poster on Twitter. It's a great poster. It looks super entertaining and action-packed. And there's some cool parts once they get caught, and there's some – kind of like intense stuff happening between them, but it's never Sybil really just comes in to show, oh, you're powerful, you know, her name's Angel, and she seems like, you know, strong and kind of regal, but they don't really give her anything to do, like you say, like there's really isn't much there.
And that's unfortunately, I think, the function she serves in too many of these kinds of movies, because as I was seeking stuff out that I'd never seen again and again, that was kind of the recurring theme, where it was like, well, we need somebody to be super strong and intimidating or sexy or whatever for a scene or two, but they don't give her a role like Chained Heat, you know, something where she can really kind of dig in and be awesome. And I was so hoping that this was going to be another Chained Heat, just because, like, oh, there's John Vernon and there's Paul L. Smith, you know, being a crazy person. And I will say that she was just my half sister did make me laugh after.
Oh, there's a massage scene where there's like golden light behind
her. Oh, yeah.
Her getting a massage from it. It's just so sleazy.
Right. And there's I guess spoilers. At one point, she gets blown up by a hand grenade, and he just says, well, she was my half sister.
It's actually a good death. Like, I think that's the best thing she doesn't. It's a fun, like, final moment for her, but that's about it. It's, I would definitely say that's like on that fringe of like, what I mean by you have to go through 10 of those to discover the Chained Heat. You know, it's not terrible. It's watchable, but it
has like the elements to be great, but then
it's
not. And I need to just have a quick sidebar about one Marjo Gortner, who, and have you seen that documentary about him?
No,
I've never seen it. So in the 70s, they made this movie called Marjo. I think you can rent it on Amazon. It won the Oscar. Because he was like a really famous preacher.
Okay.
And then he became an actor. And I always want to like him when he shows up in stuff, because he's in like Bobby Joe and the Outlaw, which everyone should see just for Linda Carter. He's in Star Crash, you know. But he's like if William Catt fucked a bird, like that's what Marjo Gortner kind of looks like. And it's supposedly this role was supposed to be Dennis Hopper, I read, and then somehow that fell out and he was replaced by Marjo Gortner, who is just a weirdly unappealing screen presence to me, because he talks and he has this terrible voice. I don't know what it is. He's something about Marjo Gortner is very off-putting to me, and yet when I find out he's in a movie, I weirdly want to see it.
That's the other thing about exploitation films, is they take all types. Like, you watch a Hollywood movie and everyone's more or less of the same type. When you think about exploitation, it's like you'll get some great actors in there, and then there's probably going to be half the people in this who aren't even actors at some point, or extra, you know, just like you're going to be putting weird groups of people,
right,
which means weird chemistry and hoping it all mixes together. And sometimes it just doesn't. I found a lot of the models to be very just banal. Yeah, there wasn't enough character in there. You know, there's no bubbles, you know, or one of those, you know, these memorable characters who don't need a lot of screen time. They just need to tell you who they are straight away. And you're like, oh, that's a cool character. Yeah, this one's, you know, I'd say fairly forgettable with, you know, with some good talent in there. But
right.
I wouldn't put it on your must-do list if you're going to get that triple pack. I haven't seen the middle one of the triple pack, which is another Linda Blair one, but not Sybil Danning. So I said, you know, save that for next year, Kane, when we do our all sleazy Linda Blair episode.
We'll just do a whole show on Savage Streets. I don't think we need to talk about anything else. But
exactly.
But speaking of essential Sybil Danning, this was a movie that I think I got turned on to by Rob on Killer POV. I think maybe he brought it up. I can't remember if it was him or you, so I don't want to give him credit.
He brought it up
you.
To
okay.
me.
Okay.
And then brought me over to his house. I think he might have like kind of loosely mentioned on the show. Maybe he did his first talk, and then he brought me to his house to watch it. And then we both like raged, or like, you know, I mean, not rage, but in that positive way, we were, you know, preaching.
Yeah.
So, but you lead away because I had kind of forgotten about it until you did a show mentioning it not long ago. When I heard you talk about it again, I think that might have been when I started thinking the Sybil thong.
I think I was talking to Jackson Stewart, and I was positive like he would have seen it and loved it because he's seen so many fucking crazy movies, and he was unaware of it. So I was so excited, like, ooh, maybe I can turn him on to this movie. And that is They're Playing with Fire.
Yep.
Which is a 1984 movie that, and I think Rob's original description was what made me excited, and it is such an apt description, which is it's a movie that begins as a teen sex comedy between Eric Brown from Private Lessons and Sybil Danning, his teacher, who seduces him and has sex with him, like in the first 15 minutes of the movie. You're like, this is the best movie ever made. And by the
like
end,
every human's fantasy, like it's like you're seeing that thing that you would hope watch a whole movie for hoping would happen, and they give it to you straight away,
like so quickly. And then by the end, it has gone full on slasher movie, and it's just bananas in the best way. It's another one of these movies that's just so entertaining because you're not sure. And that's such an exciting element of some of these exploitation movies, because they don't follow traditional rules. You go see most movies and, you know, in the first 10 minutes, once they give you the setup, you're like, okay, I know the rest of this story. Now it's just a question of how well they execute the thing that I'm expecting. But some of these movies have the ability to surprise you in that way that Julie Darling does, where you're like, well, I thought it was going to hint at incest, but here they are fucking. And They're Playing with Fire, man, does the exact same thing, where you, from those first 15 minutes, you could never guess where it's going to end.
That's the biggest shift I've ever seen, like in my life, of any movie. Like, I remember just watching it going,
it's
what?
Like it's like Something Wild almost in that way,
yeah.
Where it starts one way. Yeah.
But because the Something Wild director is so good, he's able to like somehow make the tone, make like somehow he can do it. Like, I feel like Jonathan Demme knows so control in this movie. It's more like a totally different movie, and yet it still wins you over.
Right.
It gets you into it because it's just such a fun, sleazy thing that it becomes. I think it's you know, there's not much. It's a hard thing to verbalize. Like, I think when Rob was trying to convince us to watch it, I was not convinced by that. Like, I think when somebody tells you it starts as a sex comedy and then becomes a slasher, you think that the sex comedy part would bleed into the slasher, and so it's kind of both. No, it's really like a different movie begins, and tonally is so different. You're like, wait, he's wearing a mask and he's killing, like, a character's killing people, like an actual slasher movie, right after you're promised this, like, you know, really kind of almost innocent fun. And it's a lot of fun. This is definitely one of the highlights of what we're talking about today, in terms of like maybe to just take a risk on and be like, oh, what kind of movie is this, especially if you also like sex comedies and that, because it does give you enough of that to be completely pleasing.
And I'm not the world's biggest Eric Brown fan. I think he's a little bit of like a wet blanket on screen. And it's interesting to hear on the Blu-ray that came out a couple months ago, Sybil Danning is interviewed, and she talks about how she had a really hard time. He was real prudish and weird in the sex scenes and wouldn't get into them at all. And she was trying to encourage him. And again, most of us hear that and we're like, wait, what? I don't understand. He was given this gift and didn't know what to do with it.
I understand, Eric. I've been there on screen with you. When I was interviewing her, I couldn't even get her to take her sunglasses off. I feel your pain, brother.
Maybe that's it. Maybe he just was so intimidated by her.
It could be. Like 1984 is peak Danning. That's my number one note I always write on this. This is like 84, 83. We're talking about like this is her at the height of her like just like, I don't know, confidence and sexual, everything about her on screen is just like, oh, you know. So it's I could see that. But it is. Yeah, it just tells you more about her than him, probably, in terms of that he might have been uncomfortable. But maybe that's natural for doing a sex scene where she's completely confident, which probably doesn't help him. But yeah, this is there's not much to tell people about this movie. I feel like it's one you just have to watch.
Yeah.
Because it's so surprising and fun. And it takes you in a totally, I feel like the triple feature, you know, of Chained Heat, Julie Darling and this, they're all, what order would that go in? That'd probably go Playing with Fire first.
Yeah, I would put Julie Darling middle and then you gotta end Gangbusters.
Totally, yes. So that's your triple feature from the ones we're talking about, at least so far. Even though I've got a couple more to discuss, I feel like those are the three, like just truly, they're all kind of quality movies in their exploitive, you know, beauty.
Yeah. No, that's a good time at the movies right there.
One I didn't watch all of, so I'm not going to like pretend to be able to talk about it. And it's one that I wanted to watch because I like Andy Sidaris stuff. Well, Hard Ticket to Hawaii is like amazing. And his editing is amazing. Like, I mean, it's funny. It's definitely got a lot of that so bad. It's good qualities. But there's moments of his movies that are just so genuinely funny and crazy. So I as soon as I heard that she was in one of his films called Malibu Express, 85, still peak. And, you know, it's about a private eye. Okay, there's a moment in the first few minutes of this movie where they explain that there's a high-tech computer that is responsible for Russian leaks and technology. I literally laughed out loud, and me and Brian went, oh my God, we could take that clip, put it online right now, and people would think we're talking about the current situation. It's like, even though this is an over-the-top kind of cheesy MAGI ripoff type character, way over the top. But in the first 20 minutes, I found there to be actually genuinely like really funny moments that like him shooting the first time he's at the shooting range and stuff like that. And then it's just, you know, 25, 30 minutes. And then you're like, okay, this is going to be that kind of ba-boom, ba-boom the whole way through. But it was super late when we were watching all these movies. And so I only got about 30 minutes in, but I got in enough to see Sybil enter the film and a first Sybil sex scene. So pretty quick, the first 30 minutes, she plays the Countessa, you know, and it just seemed a little clunky. Had you seen the whole thing? Because I hadn't seen the whole
thing. I watched the whole thing. Yeah, this was my first viewing. I was watching it kind of in preparation for this. And you saw most of her performance, honestly. She shows up for a few minutes at the end, but basically leaves for most of the middle of the movie, which is a problem because then it just leaves a bunch of people that I don't care about. And I almost feel like she's not a great fit for the Andy Sidaris school of filmmaking. You know, she's certainly
a real actress. She's a real actress. I think that's a problem for him, you know?
And she's too strong. She's too confident. And his movies, I'm not the biggest Andy Sidaris fan. I completely agree with you on Hard Ticket to Hawaii. That movie is kind of sublime in terms of just being crazy and provided me with one of the greatest viewing experiences of my life, because I was watching it with some friends and we were almost exhausted by the end of it, and then the snake comes back and it was like, oh my God, it was that's incredible. But it's like she just doesn't fit in this universe, and so I'm just not, his movies just tend to be too silly and a little bit, you know, some of it can be funny, but it's so just like half-assed kind of. And he's one of these guys, you know, as much as we've talked about like, oh, Sybil's hot and everything, like boobs are not that interesting. Like, relax, Andy Sidaris, you gotta have more than that. And so I don't love a lot of his movies, and this one was really kind of middle of the road. So once she leaves the movie, it's like, well, I'm left with this guy with the mustache. I don't care about this guy at all.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, the first few minutes are genuinely funny, and then this often happens with movies like that. They're relying on shtick, you know, at a certain point. But I'll return to it at some point. That's the kind of thing, if I was watching it with a group of people, I'm sure, you know, but after, I think I was two films in, it was like, you know, 1 a.m. or something, trying to watch that as, you know, a ticket to disaster. I do think there's something to what you're saying, though, her being too strong, because I think this is right around the period in her career where she kind of, this is one of the reasons why I think people should talk about her a little more, which is she tried to take control of her career. She did. And maybe she wasn't being offered Octopussy and things, so she decided to, you know, label herself and be the creator of her own work. And so one of the things for Action Video label that they started doing, and all these, I think Jungle Warriors was one of them, but she would film the intro and the outros for all these movies. And some of them she was in, some she wasn't. And like almost like basically take control of making money off the distribution side of VHS. And they're really fun, like they're really silly and over the top, and hi, I'm Sybil Danning, and you know, she's holding some big machine gun and introduces the movie. But it's really cool that she did that, and that leads to like my last pick, which is the, you know, one of the later kind of, I think later big plays she made to kind of be in charge of her own career, because she wrote the film and as a producer on it. You know, and the movie doesn't quite work. I've never seen a good copy of this movie. I've seen it on VHS once, and then for the show to kind of rewatch, I was just watching it on YouTube. And it's called LA Bounty. And it's mostly worthwhile because another guy who I imagine we have in common, a little ramrod called Wings Hauser, is just absolutely bonkers in this movie, like all his best work. He is a completely, you know, mad, you know, drug importer, smuggler, you know, bad guy. And the problem she might have made, because she's the producer, she's a co-writer on this, so this was like her character. The character was called Ruger, and in Germany, the movie's called Ruger, you know. And the director is a guy called Worth Keeter. Pardon me, and he directed almost every episode of Mighty Morphin Power Rangers ever.
How weird.
Which is probably part of the problem, because this it has a bit of a Western, like trying to be like almost Peckinpah, but it's a modern LA. She plays a bounty hunter who was a cop, and now she gets, you know, I think the character of Wings has killed her partner, you know, previously. So it becomes, you know, they're become at odds. But she is kind of like, what was that Kurt Russell movie where he has like 25 lines or words in the Soldier.
Soldier, yeah.
This is like that. She has 31 words in 85 minutes, and she's the lead character. So it's a little, which is fine, because it's like her trying to be tough, and she is tough, and she comes across as strong. But then when you give Wings Hauser all the other lines, there's no way you're not going to be eclipsed. And I feel like her and him would actually be kind of nicely matched on screen in a movie. But in this movie, I think she gave him, and the trailer too, and I was looking at the trailer before, I was like, oh, wow, they're even highlighting how great he is in this. And it takes away from, if you're trying to launch a new character, I got the feeling this was like a play at trying to create like a little universe for herself, a recurring, you know, role,
right,
that she could be in charge of. And I think because she let the character get sublimated by his character, and it's a bummer. It's not a great movie. I wouldn't put it in the must see as the other three, but it's kind of cool, and it's got some pretty good action, and it's fun to see her taking charge of like her actual career as the, you know, writer producer. And it makes me, and I'm sure there's other examples towards the end, but this was like one of the last big ones. She had a comic book that I sent you, the Black Diamond.
Yeah,
with the Marvel. She had like four issues of that where she was trying to get that character off. Even when I interviewed her, I think she was still trying to turn that into a video game, you know, and she was talking about, so I have a lot of respect for, you know, it's better than just dying out. She's always trying to, you know, keep reinventing the career. And I just wish, you know, somebody would also make it easier on her by just putting her in something cool.
Yeah.
This, I don't know if you, have you seen this one?
I tried so hard to find a copy of it for this, because once I saw that she had written a movie, and then when I saw that Wings Hauser was in it, I was like, well, this is for sure coming up. But I could not find, Amazon has like some VHSs, but otherwise I was not able to find a copy.
It might have played on TCM. I'm trying to think where I've seen a decent version once, and it must have been TCM, or maybe it's that the Rodriguez channel or something. Something played it once where it looked good, and I was like, oh wow. But then since then, it's unfortunate. But that would be a fun, like, I don't know who would put that up. Probably Code Red or Vinegar Syndrome, maybe that kind of movie.
Yeah,
I think it'd be fun. But you'll appreciate it just for Wings. It's definitely probably maybe, you know, top few of his performances. No, it's not Ramrod. Don't get me wrong. Like, you know, you can't go all that. Did you know, for Ramrod lovers out there, we're talking about Vice Squad, Gary Sherman, one of the greatest things. That's up there with Chain Heat for me in terms of just.
And oh, for sure. Probably, yeah.
Yeah, it's a better movie. It's definitely a better made movie. But I did not know he was like a Young and the Restless guy. And I started looking him up and I started seeing all these clips of him like early in his career. And it was just like mind blowing. It's that or Days of Our Lives. I can't remember which one, but he was actually, and I don't mean like for a season. I mean for like 100 episodes or something. Like, it just blew my mind that he started in that world, because he's such a good actor in his way. You know, a lot of people think he's over the top and because he's cast again in a lot of crap. So he kind of, I think he has to do a little more for that reason. But I think if he had been in all, you know, all mainstream Hollywood stuff, people would have, like Tom Berenger type roles, people would be, you know, remember him as a great actor.
Yeah. It was The Young and the Restless, and he was on, yeah, in the 80s, and then apparently came back in 2010.
I think they did like a reunion thing or something when I was looking it up. But it's worth, if you're a fan, it's worth looking up like YouTube clip, because it's kind of fun, because he's kind of the same guy. It's just on some soap opera. It's kind of mind-blowing.
He did a whole run on Roseanne, too, I remember.
I don't remember that.
He showed up for a while on there. But, yeah, my first Vice Squad experience was at a midnight show at the Music Box, and I think I won tickets, and I took my wife, who was probably just my girlfriend then, and there was like 10 people there. We were in the big theater in the Music Box, and it started up, and he's singing the opening title song, Neon Slime, and I was like, I am all the way in on this movie.
He's so awesome, yeah. And he's even like, what was that, Rubber? You know, he's in Rubber.
Yeah.
With the tire. And it's neat to see him. I mean, he's obviously slowing down a bit. But, yeah, he's just a great screen presence. And, you know, I feel like I still think there's a great Sybil role to be cast. I think she's still somebody, you know, that's the interesting thing about aging, right? Like, obviously, actresses, it's always been a problem for actresses, like, not getting cast in later years, until recently with television opening up. But still, I feel like I watch her and I go, oh, I bet there's something there. She would just knock it out of the park if you gave. Again, you have to write these things with these people in mind, I think, because you see Alan Barkin always get really great roles, you know, playing kind of tough and vicious. But I think there's something out there. There's something that yet to be done.
I would hope so. I love that she did create sort of that little, or at least tried to, that little cottage industry in the 80s, kind of branding herself as a thing, because I love that it existed outside the mainstream, but that it was a thing, you know, it was a brand, Sybil Danning, and that I like the actors who are kind of big names to us because they star in certain kinds of movies and they're on a certain level. And so to us, they're royalty, you know.
And it's probably also why they aren't cast in bigger things at times, right? Because if you're doing like the intros and outros to VHS, you probably aren't going to be in that next Spielberg film. But you also just have to take charge, I guess, you know, of your career. But, you know, I feel like she really could have been on par with, in that time period, on par with the big male action stars of the time, given the right roles. She definitely had that charisma. But, you know, there's still plenty. I mean, I feel like I bet you there's another two or three, you know, really great movies in her filmography that I haven't discovered yet. I feel like there's a couple. I haven't seen Bluebeard. I heard that one discussed. And
what's the one she did with Klaus Kinski? They're holding up a plane.
Airport?
It's not.
Concorde?
It's, oof. There, she did some stuff in the 70s that I haven't.
A Franco Nero film that looked really good.
Yeah, that Cobra one.
Yeah, if we hadn't done this so soon, I had just kind of discovered the, like, I saw the poster art and Thesaurus out, and I was like, ooh, if I had time to, like, order that, I would like to. But that can be next year's.
Yeah,
film,
right? She did a couple, like, giallo movies in the 70s, Red Queen Kills Seven Times, which I've seen, and she's not a huge factor in it.
Yeah, she's good at it. I mean, it's a fun role. It's an interesting movie, but yeah, when she's only in it for a scene or two or just playing a sex thing, it's not, you know, it's not important. You know, it's like we want to see her when she's actually got something to do.
Right. I can't believe I can't find the name of that.
The Kinski one doesn't ring a bell, but I mean, it makes sense that they would have been on screen together. And now I must see it.
Right. That's, I mean,
I'm not going to not watch those two on screen together. I'm sorry.
It's like I'm based on a true story, and they are like terrorists holding a plane hostage.
Huh?
I feel bad that I can't.
I feel like you dreamed this movie.
It's entirely possible. I did. What? Oh, this is so upsetting. It's unfortunate that, you know, all the pressure seems to be on Tarantino to revive these careers, that there aren't other actor or other filmmakers kind of taking it upon themselves. I mean, again, Rob Zombie every once in a while helped bring back a Sid Haig, or
Rodriguez does.
Yeah.
Obviously with Don Johnson, people like that he would throw in there. But there aren't, but he's really just copying Tarantino's model,
right,
in a sense.
Right.
I would just as likely, you know, put her in Richard Linklater's serious movie, and I'd be like, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see actors like that in a really meaty, serious Sundance drama, you know, and like, you know, a character gets out of jail and is putting their life together, and see what they would do. Like, take the Erica character, but treat it realistically. And what happened when that character got out of jail 40 years later, like, right, who is that person,
right,
and watch them in a movie, like, oh, okay, like, I think she would have the now whether she would have the patience or feel you wanting to do that stuff, for all we know she could be married to a billionaire. I remember thinking about Jessica Harper recently, you know, from Suspiria, and always going, why is that person, how could she not have been in more movies? It's like, yeah, she married like the head of an entire studio, so
right,
she didn't need to do it anymore. So some people just, you know, don't necessarily have the desire. But you're right. I mean, with Quentin too, he casts based on his love, not collective love. So just because,
right,
collectively we see Sybil Danning as important doesn't mean that he personally was ever a fan. For all we know, that might have been one of the people who didn't have a thing, you know. So he's very specific, which is why he's good at it,
right?
Because you have to do it out of love, not because of, oh, that person deserves their shots. Like, yeah, who cares about that? You know, it's, I think him putting Robert Forster in Jackie Brown is one of the just great pieces of casting, because that was, you know, well before Forster was, you know, somebody we all recognized from anything on TV right now or movies. He couldn't even find him. I mean, the story behind that casting is unbelievable. There was a place when I first moved to LA across the street from me, Silver Spoon it was called, and it was the place where every single day I saw Robert Forster there. And yeah, I moved here, I was like, oh my god, like Robert Forster sitting across, and he would go in and wave to everyone and then read his paper and all this stuff. And I found out like later that the only Tarantino, he had no agent anymore, he hadn't acted in years, and Tarantino, the word got out that Tarantino was literally trying to find this guy. And then somebody said, well, I heard he goes to Silver Spoon all the time. So Quentin just found him at the diner and sat down and like pitched him the thing. So
wow,
to know that that's where Tarantino comes from is why I will never put up with people who like slag him off.
Right.
Because I'm like or dislike his movies, this is a guy who it's so legitimate, that love of movies, and that it's coming out in a way that's so organic that that's why it works half the time. And it's not anything calculating about it whatsoever. You know, it's really, that's what makes it so full of joy to me.
I read recently that Robert Forster was David Lynch's original pick.
Yes.
To play Harry Truman on Twin Peaks, which I did not know.
And now he's back in it playing,
right,
his brother.
Right.
Because that guy, that actor is not in the new series. I mean, I'm not sure if he doesn't appear at all, but I know he wasn't in it initially. I don't know. Maybe they'll have a trick up their sleeve and pull him out at some point. But yeah, that's pretty cool. And he was meant to be, if you watch Mulholland Drive, which was meant to be a TV pilot,
right,
he was really would have been the main character of that show, or like, in, you know, as much as anyone's a main character in Lynch's kind of world, like Twin Peaks, but he would have been a major figure, like as the main detective. And so when you watch the movie, he's in like one scene and you're like, hey, it's Robert Forster. So it's a little dislocating, but you know, it's kind of cool to think he would have been in that. I think he's one of my favorite things about the new Twin Peaks. He's only been in like really one episode,
yeah,
but he grounded the whole show just by entering, because he's such a real actor. He just feels like his presence is like instantly feels like a real dude just walked into the show. So it's kind of awesome.
That movie is called Operation Thunderbolt. It does exist. It's directed by Menachem Golan of Golan Globus,
yes,
fame.
So I've seen that in the documentary on him,
okay,
at least a clip of it. We have to do a follow up, like a little bonus, or we're going to have to Wait till next year and Civilthon 2018 will be older, pervier, and the movies we'll pick will be not quite as good.
I know this doesn't seem like the kind of movie that's going to provide the same thrill as Chained Heat.
I feel like our goal, no, but this is a nice goal. We are going to have to watch a lot more of them to see if we can discover another golden Sybil title, because Sybil and Klaus Thon, oh my God.
Yikes. I can't maybe imagine what that set one was like.
Oh, yeah, no, that's just too much. It's like, I can't, him in general, it's just, the stories about him are just so outlandish. Even if some of it is a performance on his part, it is just outlandish. The word was, the reason he was in so much crap in the last like 20 years of his life was that he only took deals with cash. And so when Sergio Leone, Clint Eastwood, I'm not sure if it was Spielberg, but somebody like that, he turned all of those people down at certain points because, you know, it was like a normal deal. Right. And he said he wanted a suitcase with money in it, cash in it, and he would take the role. And it didn't matter what the project was. It could be like the biggest piece of shit and some gangsters showing up with a thing of money. He did it every time. That was his thing. Cash money, he did the role. So all those crazy movies you see, and Herzog explains it at one point, just talking about this is why he did it. You know, this is the person he became. It was because he was super paranoid. He was like super paranoid that they, you know, wouldn't come through. So it didn't matter if it was Spielberg. He was like, no, I'd rather take a suitcase of money and do Crawl Space.
This explains so much of Crawl Space.
I mean, it really does. It explains a lot about his career because the guy, you watch the guy Nosferatu or Aguirre and you're like, all right, so one of the greatest,
right,
you know, physical performers. But like, oh, man, but not when you put him in those movies. It's a hard thing, you know, for some actor. I feel like that we could make some parallels to Nicolas Cage. Like, I think he's the best screen actor alive when he's working with great directors.
Right.
And he's with the right director. There is no one I would rather watch in a movie than Nicolas Cage. But when he's not, even though we get a lot of funny, what the fuck kind of stuff, you realize like, it's a different person. And so, you know, it's a tough thing because the actors aren't meant to direct themselves. You know, they're meant to just give you what they got. And if it's a shit movie and you've given them something kind of ridiculous, then it's not necessarily going to work. So the idea of the news story, the most exciting news story in the last, you know, week for me is the new film by Panos Cosmatos, Beyond the Black Rainbow, is going to star Nick Cage for, you know, Spectrevision. When I read that, I was like, yes, yeah. I watch that, whatever that is.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. You know, good or bad, it's going to be interesting. So.
Right. Which is all you can hope for sometimes, especially when it comes to somebody like Nicolas Cage, who is rarely even interesting anymore, unfortunately, you know. But then you read stories like he owns an island, and you're like, well, now I understand why he does all these shitty movies.
Oh, yeah, I'd take lots of part-time jobs for an island. Like, islands are really totally worth it if you can. I mean, it's hard to get, but yeah. I don't know, I'm telling you, like, I look back at Bad Lieutenant 2 and I go, yep, okay. So he just needs somebody, you know, to guide that thing he gets. And in a lot of ways, you could view that as a very strong attribute for an actor, is to kind of give it all you've got. And sometimes it's going to go off in the wrong direction with the wrong director because you didn't, you know, no one was watching, steering the ship while you were too busy, you know, being the engine. You can steer it. You know, I do think that's important with, you know, great performers like that. But man, look back at Wild at Heart, Moonstruck, Valley Girl. It's just so many movies. He's great. That can't be a fluke. I don't accept when people go, Nick Cage is so bad. It's like, I'm sorry. No. That is not accidental. That is talent. He's got raw talent. It's, you know.
For years, he was my favorite actor, you know, and partially based on like when I heard the story that he got Peggy Sue, got married, and then decided to do the whole thing as Pokey. And I was like, I have to love a guy who's going to get an opportunity like that, working for Uncle Francis opposite Kathleen Turner, one of the biggest movie stars at the time, and like make a crazy choice like that and just go for it. And that was what I always loved about him, was that he went for it. And that has been the heartbreak of, you know, this kind of direct-to-video era, is that he's just kind of phoning it in, you know?
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of just general performances of normal guy.
Right.
He doesn't really suit normal guy. But I hope people don't forget he can eat a peach for hours. And any man who can do
that
deserves a place.
Charlie Spradling, who I bring up a lot on this show. The girl in that story is Charlie Spradling, who made a bunch of like Full Moon movies. And I'm a Charlie Spradling fan.
I feel like that's the thing that's most signaled you being creepy in this episode. Much more than the 2 hours of Sybil Danning talk we just did.
Well, this was super fun. I hope that Sibylthon becomes an annual tradition. Even if we're just watching the same five movies every year, I would do. We'll just check in on Chained Heat once a year. Just like...
I still like that one part. Yeah, I like that. I think we need to do Sing in Person, which will be a lot of fun. And then if we can get you in person, we'll definitely do a Pure Cinema episode at some point. I think that'll be a lot of fun.
That would be awesome. Yeah, tell everybody where to... To tell you the truth, everybody who listens to this show already knows where to find you, but where can everybody find you online?
The internet. It's that's the place. I don't know if there's specific parts of the internet to go to, but I do know it's there. No, I mean, I know we're just Pure Cinema at something, and we're on the nowstreamingnetwork.net.
Now playing network.
Yeah, we're there too.
I need to do your PR.
I know, I'm terrible. I get that wrong every episode, but I do love it. We're there. We're on the iTunes or wherever you listen to stuff. Yeah. And Shockwaves is still going. We've got one more episode, then we'll be on break for a couple weeks. And season two, we decided with Pure Cinema to do a different kind, because I don't know about you, but sometimes I feel like that expectation that a podcast is on every week and goes forever, for eternity, sometimes feels a little daunting and like – aimless. And so just recently, after what, 4.5 years, I think we've been doing Shockwaves, however long it's been, there was just that part of me that started going, but why, you know, not in danger of like I want to stop, but also like, but what's the end goal, is where is this headed,
right?
And because I will never be able to get that sense for that show, probably, because we'll just keep, you know, where I think as long as all of us want to do it, we'll always keep doing that show because we enjoy it. It's a fun thing to do. Whereas if I was going to do something else, I needed more structure, and I wanted it to be something that like I could choose what we're doing, you know, not just solely with Brian as well, but I like the idea of being like, oh, well, what if we just do it like more like TV? So you're doing 12 episodes and then you take break and you make more. And then and it just felt like giving it a little bit of that. Now, I don't know if that's going to make it less popular, because I guess, you know, in the podcasting world, everyone always tells you, you know, got to be consistent every week.
Right.
I got to a point where I'm like, wait a minute. The show I really like listening to sometimes, that Bret Easton Ellis, sometimes hit and miss with Bret Easton Ellis when he rages about bullshit, but but it's like I turn it on and go, wait, that didn't come this month or next and now it's every week. Wait, now it's three times. So there is that kind of inconsistency, which is problematic. I agree. I definitely think, but I do think, like, if as long as you can kind of tell your listeners what it's going to be, get it across, I think, you know, hopefully it won't kill people's enthusiasm for it. I just think to stay interested is what's important, to stay like, to stay caring about what you talk about, because as soon as that's gone, if somebody suddenly listens and goes, their show's okay, but Elric's not very passionate about movies, it's like, if that ever happened, clearly I view myself as someone that's the only attribute I bring to this world. In my I don't know what other people get from me, but I do know, I can see it from the inside outside, that I am passionate about, you know, the things I talk about. And so, you know, I just want to retain that and, you know, meet interesting people and talk about movies, keep old movies alive, you know.
I've been going for 7 years of every week, and there are certainly times where you are staring into the abyss and questioning all of your choices. And then...
You can't be talking about the one you did with your wife.
1 week.
I love the one with you and your wife.
Oh, that's very nice of you.
I loved it because of being someone married. I did. Just the way you guys were talking made me laugh, because I could also hear in your voice, like, I don't even have anything to do this week. What am I even doing here? But there's that curmudgeonly side, but then she's like working so hard, like somebody trying to make somebody enjoy a birthday present that they didn't like. And she is just like doing it and just laying it down and making it as fun as she possibly can. And I have utmost respect for that. That is
an extension of our entire relationship, is her finding joy in things that are killing me. Yeah, so it's, you know, some weeks are rough, and then every once in a while something will come along, like you get to talk about Sybil Danning for an entire episode and you remember why you do this in the first place.
I love that we're not talking about horror, because both of our love and everything we bonded over initially is purely about horror, and it's so funny that when we finally came together, it's about Sybil Danning of all things.
What else could it possibly
Glory be?
I think this came about because we were both on Twitter talking about movies we would never want to see. And then somebody chimed in with like, oh, that movie's really good. And you're like, yeah, it might be, but I think I'd rather, you know, sit through.
Oh, that's right. It was a
Sybil Danning movie.
Michelle Pfeiffer journalism movie.
Yes, maybe.
You actually listened. you wrote a movie. It's one that I've always thought about never wanting to watch. And you had said you didn't want to. And I was like, oh, that's so funny. We both really don't want to watch the same movie. So we should start a Sybil Fawn.
Right. And that was how this came about. And here we are.
I hope Sybil listens to this and just knows that she was loved and is loved and that we appreciate her. And that's all she needs to know. How?
Thank you for listening, everyone. Thank you, Elric, for coming on. This was super fun.
Quote Predator anytime.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.